Last week in our Promise and Practice service, we did readings and brought it in where the voices of people of color were centered in the service, and I stepped to the side. And one of our readings was that words matter, and we looked at where our sign says, "Love welcomes all," and then you come in and you hear words of inclusion and diversity and welcome, but how that strikes hollow if you don't find those voices and that experience here. We had a story and readings from different perspectives of trying to be included in this faith, in this place, in this world. And one of the things we didn't do was a story for the children. And Vicki was going to do it this Sunday, but she has the flu and has been down with the flu all week. And if she had been here, this is a story. It's called Repairing Our Mistakes with Love. And it's a story, the way it's set up is two people do it, and you come in with a broken plate or a cup, and one person is supposed to bring it for the morning, and they bring in the plate, but it's broken, and so they say, "I'm feeling upset about this. Can we try to fix it?" And then they get in a conversation with the other person saying, "Well, why should I fix it? I didn't break it, you know? I didn't do it." And then the conversation also goes into, "I'm a good person. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't break a plate." But they said, "Well, that's fine, but can you help me fix it anyway?" And so and share that it's important. And then the children are invited in to try to figure out how to fix this plate. So you have a broken plate. And then I actually brought, you know, you have tape or you have Loctite glue. They even, in the story, hand out pieces of gum to the children to chew. And then they use it to fix the plate, and then they solicit suggestions for that for everybody. But then the person who brought the plate says, "I have an idea. It's called kintsugi." And it turns out that kintsugi is the ancient Japanese art of repairing broken pottery and ceramics, where gold is used to highlight the beauty of the imperfections that remain when a broken item has been repaired. And if you look at the photos of this, it really, it's just amazing. And I hadn't understood this before reading this story. It's called kintsugi. And so person A says, "So what I'm learning is that the point of kintsugi isn't to hide the broken parts, right?" The other person says, "That's right. The gold is used to remind the user over and over that something that is once broken is whole again, and it has a different beauty." And then they said, "In a way, that's what happens when other things break, right?" The other person says, "Like what kind of things?" Well, you can see where this is going. "Like relationships, friendships. Sometimes we hurt each other's feeling, and it's like the thread between two or more people breaks. But as Unitarian Universalists, we don't ignore that. We try to rebuild the relationship so that it's stronger than it was before. I agree. The work of healing is all of our jobs, no matter how big or small we are. And when we repair our mistakes with love and with our covenant, we remember that our relationships are more beautiful once we have acknowledged hurt, asked for forgiveness, corrected our mistakes, and made a sacred promise to do better in the future." I don't know if I would read that as a part of a K-5 story in that language. But it said, "When our children then go to their classes, we adults will be thinking about how to heal our relationships." And that was in the case with Black Lives of Unitarian Universalists and people of color, so that our faith and our congregations can be more beautiful than they were before. But as I was... as I was reading about this, I remembered, and looking for something broken, I remembered this chalice. This chalice was given to us by the Reverend Charles Grady, who was my was the minister here when I came, okay? And he and his wife Claudine lived here for, I don't know, over 12, 14 years into that ministry. And he had given this chalice to the congregation. And somehow it had gotten broken. And it just sat in the corner because it didn't know what to do with it. So it just ignored it. It was broken, so it wasn't any good. But now I realize what? Rather than be silent, rather than just leave it in the corner, gold joinery, kintsugi, we can actually take these pieces, figure them out. Not in front of a crowd. But find their place, and then you would have gold in the seams once you figured it out. And the chalice would be brought out of just ignoring it and leaving it in the corner to it being this beautiful, mended object that then becomes part of life again. Kintsugi. And the other reading is from letter from a Birmingham jail from Martin Luther King. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, "I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action," who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another person's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. Letter from a Birmingham jail, 1963. And the way I looked that up was I was looking up the quote by Martin Luther King Jr., which says, "In the end, we will not remember the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." The idea for this Sunday and what I wrote and put on the sign was "Wait to see." It was the idea of how do we, what do we need to hear? What do we need to hear to make sense of the events of the weeks that have led up to today? And I can tell you, I didn't hear anything. There was silence. Nobody came back with suggestions or what they wanted to hear. So I have a message, unless you have something you'd like to hear today. One of the things I'd like to bring forward is what I heard about the Women's March, which makes sense to me and offers me hope. I heard that the whole march in Asheville was organized by four high school girls, ages 15 and 16, to make that happen. Wow, four high school girls. Is there anything else from that experience that you'd like to share or say? Four high school girls. Peggy, you need a mic?
No, I can watch.
No.
That was a statement, not a question.
It was from your husband.
What? The whole thing was awesome yesterday, but those four girls, and anyone that was there, I think will agree with me. And I think it was one of the 15-year-olds that said, and I'm paraphrasing, she said, "You don't have to be old enough to vote. You don't have to be old enough to drink. You don't have to be old enough to drive a car to care about what's going on. And it gave you so much hope, because this is an awesome thank you, parents of children this age, generation that's coming.
Yes, Peggy's exactly right. And in addition, Tom and I were there last year and this year also, along with Susan. And what was so encouraging to me, besides these awesome young women, was how many young people were marching. The streets were full of young people. Lots of times when we're out protesting, they look like most of us. But this time, there were lots of young people and lots of little children. And that gave me lots and lots of hope.
I agree with all that you've said so far. And continuing on that theme of young people and older people, it was, were families there. I have a sense that this was something that families were doing together. Men and women, fathers, mothers, children, including my own family. It was actually the second march for my granddaughter, who's 14 months old.
I think when I hear those that it was organized by four teenage girls, I realize how so much of what I say anymore is not leading into the future in the same way that they are. In other words, that what I'm doing, speaking to myself, are issues for many people that they've already resolved and moved on, and this is a part of their way of life, and then how they make this real in the world. What I wanted to talk to you about this morning follows from last Sunday's service, the practice and the promise, making intentions real. 2 years ago, I don't think that I could have heard that service with a broad openness. I would have always had in my mind the yes buts reacting or trying to struggle with different concepts and analyses. I couldn't really have just embraced it as it happened. I hadn't been made aware. And what I'd like to say is that, in the same way, that this congregation, this faith understanding, this challenge, this understanding and sense has created common sense for me of meaning. 2 years ago, I didn't have the understandings I had, and my analysis didn't move in the directions it does now. Where I understood then that prejudice, that is, one group is better than another, or different feelings towards different groups, plus power equals racism. I understood that without power, you can be prejudiced, but you're not racist because you can't make that prejudice effective. You're not leading it into the world. But then I moved into the understanding of how that prejudice combined with the power and with the way I'm embodied becomes white privilege. If the prejudice is that whites are better, it becomes white privilege. And that's what I grew up in. And that white privilege, then I struggled with the understanding that what that results in is a system of white supremacy, being that white is over others. It's a result of the distribution of power in a prejudicial system. Now, I could struggle with that word, and I would go right away, and people go, I hate that phrase because I'm not a white supremacist. I didn't say that. But I also say that I'm not reacting to that phrase anymore. You can use it, but I don't associate with that because I'm not. But I do live and participate and am a part of this system of white supremacy. I stand up here even as a result of it. I grew up thinking that my voice should be heard. I was told by my mother that I should be a leader. And why did she do that? It had to do with how I was embodied and how it's viewed in the world. But I've gotten to where I could step back and hear the voices from last Sunday without being or getting defensive. Remember when Daniel Benavidez and I did the litany? If you were here at the service, it was a lamentation for two voices. And it's one white and one person of color. And we were asked to repeat, and the line for people of color was, the line for those who identify as white, which was the majority of our voices, was, so much has been lost. The line for people of color was, beloved, you must not be defensive when you hear our hurt. You don't go to, I know, but I'm a good person. Let me tell you about what I did in civil rights marches in those days or what my experiences were. We confess before the Spirit of wholeness and reconciliation that we have needed to be right and needed to be white more than we needed to listen. We have entrenched our white obliviousness in our identity as good people. So much has been lost. And we said, so much has been lost. And then Daniel said, beloved, you must not be defensive when you hear our hurt. And it was repeated, beloved, you must not be defensive when you hear our hurt. So not taking it personally, while still knowing that I am personally responsible for my response. Martin Luther King, from our reading, shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. Events of the last couple of weeks make this abstract analysis of racism very real for me, particularly the role of complicit silence. And then I had to go to sort of lukewarm acceptance. But the role of complicit silence, it's easy to focus on Donald Trump. It's easy to focus on him and as the person who said S-hole countries. But then if you start looking around at the responses all around him are not new. They're not something different. There's something we saw in the 60s. If you were there, if you look back at the tapes, the presentations, any of it, it's all about prejudice and power. It's all about keeping your power by staying quiet so that you don't say anything or making apologies for that remark and then for the sentiment of countries and people who don't need to be here. Prejudice and power. The silence is more around him is actually more insidious than coming out and saying the word S-hole countries. It's the old story, the old racist story about power and keeping it. The focus is on Trump as if he's the problem. But the behavior around him, his remarks, and then the budget negotiations bring the systemic nature of white and class privilege into sharp relief. So you can't just sit there and go, I'm mad at him, so I'm just going to sit here. The question becomes, what are you going to do to break the silence of yourself? What am I going to do? I'm not saying you. What am I going to do to break the silence of myself? And why do anything? Because I live in the system. I benefit from it. It's okay not to, in many ways. You can make arguments. Except as Unitarian Universalists, we have to do something. We have to respond. We cannot remain silent and feel whole. It isn't possible. You're always bothered by the fact that there's a crack that hasn't been mended. Our orientation says one human family, one origin, one nature, one destiny, and the way to live well is to make that vision real. The way to feel like you're living a good life is not just to settle into the privilege, but to make the inclusive vision real through your actions. If I could say differently, I would say differently, but I know that to be true. We are part of one human family, one family of being. To live well, to be in right relationship with life, to be in love, to live in love, I'm called to help make that inclusive vision real in my life, in this congregation, and in the world. I'm called to make the worlds real. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I would add that in this federal budget crunch, ignoring the politics and blame for a moment, if you can, because that's the most of what is going on, is a war between personalities at this point. I would add that it's this universalism that orients my emphasis and values. Universalism said a loving God would not condemn people to hell. One human family. It says we are going to be drawn forward by love, not react to fear. We're going to be challenged by love. It orients my emphasis and values and then frames the issues to which I'm drawn. So if you orient from an emphasis on love more than fear, you come to values of freedom, inclusion, and care. You could frame that as being really concerned about our children who have grown up here and just don't happen to have the right papers at this moment in time. We name them DACA children, but our children, freedom, inclusion from countries in need, people who need us and need this place, and care, the whole question of the opioid crisis and how to care for those people in need. Those speak to me more than the language of fear, the language that calls for the military spending. Yes, I want that. I want the military supported. The border wall, the immigration restrictions, but the emphasis on love, freedom, inclusion, and care speak to me. In our book study group, Christ for Unitarian Universalists, that we started this last month, in the introduction, there's an emphasis on Pope Francis and liberation theology. There's a phrase there that keeps coming back to mind. It's Jesus's what? Preferential option for the poor. Think about that phrase as you watch what's going on in our government. And just think how that would frame what is going on. A preferential option for the poor. That's how I frame my understandings. And how this faith, By faith, I don't mean it as a prescriptive box. I just mean it as a way to form meaning and focus that connects with all that is in a way that makes sense. How this faith has helped me. So think about it. Think about, for most of you in this room right now, how much your privilege as retirees has brought you to this place, has helped us, helped each of us, and you're going right away. I earned mine, you know, it didn't help me. I worked hard, I got through this, you know. I sweated bullets, and it's because I'm a good person. That's all true. But it's also helped us earn time, money, and choices. So how are we to use those? I would offer that to feel whole, it's not just to move to a great climate and be in a great community, but it's this question of kintsugi. What is the gold that will mend the pieces that makes this whole and beautiful in a new way for you? I don't know the answer, but here's what I did in the last week. I heard the message, and I tried to give it form and voice. I tried to do my things to break the silence of hearing words and waiting for action. When we took up a collection last week, and this isn't a fundraising, you know, promotion here, but when we took the collection for the endowment for Black Lives of Unitarian Universalists, trying to match the $1 million that a donor gave, there's $1 million from the Unitarian Universalist Association, and there are two more to raise, making it $5 million. An endowment that just says, we're going to use that to center the voices and experiences of people of color into our faith, into our conversation. Wow, that's exciting too. Remember that time on Mother's Day when I said, my mother is the portal through which the universe became me. And at that exact instance, the cell phone went off with the Star Wars theme. Get back to this. So in that collection, I thought, what am I going to do? And I said, all right, I'm going to give this much. And then they don't want me to say this. You got it? Very good. So I actually thought, and I only did a little thing, but I actually thought, wait a minute, as I'm hesitating here, I'm here because of my white privilege. I'm here because of what I have gained. So how can I share that? How can I be a part of it? So it made it where I said, okay, I'll give 10% and I'll double it if we get to a certain level, and I'll double it if we get to the next level. I'll do that. That's not a big deal. But what I'm saying is I heard in my head, I heard that voice of, how do I make this difference? At the Martin Luther King Jr. breakfast, I thought and had this idea. We heard words and then we walked out. And I thought, you know, we should have been charged in that breakfast for every one of us to make a lunch date with a person of a different color so that we could begin to be in relationship, spend our time, our energy, our emotional presence to be in connection. I did a prayer at the day of service, which was at noon, and I want to share what I said with you there, and it connected with that idea. I went with that idea from what I'd said in the morning, and I said, I really don't have to do anything about white supremacy. I don't, because I live in it, I benefit from it, but I have to, because I'm Unitarian Universalist. And what I said was, when we talk about beloved community, common unity, it brings the common good into reality in our community. We were filling bags of food, and we talked about it as communion, the embodiment or the incarnation of the common good. God, one human family, one origin, one nature, one destiny, one love, the creator of the common good. So what is the relationship of these words? It points to the relationships that move community beyond words and ideas to make community real. How do we do that? And I said in the closing prayer, I said, Spirit of life and love, God of community and gifter and caretaker, holder of the common good, in the face of all that separates us from each other and you, as we go from this day, help us to move from service to relationship, from discomfort to action, from inconvenience to commitment, from acquaintance to friendship. May the nourishment of beans and rice, the food we share, become the communion of relationship, the connection of neighbors for the embodiment of the common good and the actual creation of the beloved community. Here in this, our town, in this, our home, among us, its people, in the name of all that we hold most holy. Amen. I'm going to look into being sensitive to the issues of appropriation, to consider how to regularly include the wisdom and experience and the voices of people of color in worship and in our congregation. I'm struck by the example that I heard when I went to a sanctuary workshop that I've told you about where the women in a Mars Hill Catholic congregation, but they started going out to lunch together. So there were Latina and Anglo women having lunch together. And then out of that lunch, they got the idea, when there was the fear over the ICE program, let's cook supper for the law enforcement officers and invite them to come to our supper. And so they did. They brought the sheriff and five or six of his deputies and people from Marshall. What is that county? Madison County. And they brought the Mars Hill security force. They brought Marshall's police chief in there for supper. And as she said, the woman said, boy, they growing big up there. And it was a small kitchen. But they ate food together. And this idea came out of these women sharing and spending time together. And then the law enforcement officers loved it. They wanted to do it again. So if you look at it, you think about it, the women actually came up with the idea of let's seduce these guys with a meal. But they came up with it and it worked. And I keep thinking, that's what we need to be thinking, is how to be in real relationship with each other and then in our community. And in a way, if you look at everything I've just said, it's just ways to stimulate you to think, because what I've suggested, my repairs are weak. They're not strong. They're not robust. They're just my early efforts at mending these pieces of the chalice. But I would offer that I'm going to start trying to learn kintsugi. I'm going to try to learn how to use that gold in beauty, in healing, in love to bring it all together. That's how hope and putting the new pieces together lives. New ways, new beauty. One of my framings of hope that came out of all my work in divinity school years ago has to do with the notion that hope doesn't just live with making the future perfect or right or getting to the future. It lives in the present and in what we do. A medical way of framing it is there is healing to be found even when there is no cure. That's the hope. There is healing to be found. There is a world to be mended. There are lives to be made whole. Let us go out and try to do that. Let us go inward and try to make that real. Hope makes sense here. Let us practice it together. Does anybody have any questions or comments at this point from that?